none whatever. It was purely financial. Purely financial. How much does it cost to put two ships through the Panama Canal?
Yeah, well, how did the officers feel about this? Were they
terrible?
Shortchanged?
Terrible.
Were they angry?
Very angry. Very angry.
Well, this would be the Bennett government now. This is 32. Or government's government. Didn't matter whether it was Bennett or King or anyone else.
Well, as we often say, conservative paint is no better than liberal paint. But I don't want to become partisan about this. In any way, I've forgotten which government was in power.
But in
32, the way we looked about it was not politically at all. The way we looked on it was that we needed that training. We needed the exercises, the gunnery and the torpedoes and the anti-submarine activities and so on, in order to become a developed, complete ship. And we were deprived of that, which was very short-sighted. This was in 1932. We only had 7 years to go before we were
into war. Well, we have the Depression at this time now. How did was there a noticeable change in facilities and money made available and things?
Oh, very much so. Our pay had been cut 10%. This applied to all the armed forces, judges, and the RCMP, I think. That, you know, 10% of $150 a month is a big slice.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us who were married found it extremely difficult to get by, but then so was everybody else during the Depression. So we were probably very fortunate to have jobs at all, which I think saved a lot of people from leaving the service at that time. You know, the greener pastures did not look,
yes.
Or distant pastures did not look greener.
Hmm. How were civilian-military relations at this time, do you know, like in Esquimalt, were those... Or do you stay pretty much to yourselves, or...?
Well, the armed forces have always had a tendency to be separated from civilians, except insofar as family and firm old friends are concerned, not by design or anything of that nature, but simply that we were happy within our own circle.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's true that after a few years in the service, you learn to speak a language of your own. And I think this probably has an effect. To mix with civilians and the local populace and everything all costs money. And we didn't have any money. We were skimming pretty close to the deadline.
Well, what about not only like in the army and things, they had regiments, and the regiments had carried on tradition or whatever you wish to call it, you know, regimental headquarters and their dining rooms and things. Now, how would the equivalent for you people now in the Esquimalt, were there palatial circumstances for the officers' club and things like that, or were they?
Oh no, we made the best that we could out of what we had. Most the accommodation was all that which had been built many, many years before by the Royal Navy, and had been kind of willed to us, and we took over really ample quarters for the numbers of people involved, and we lived quite contentedly, and in our own ships and so on. There being a shortage of money, we dug into our own pockets for such stuff as extra fine paint and and metal polish to polish our ships and make them look better.
You come out of your own pocket for things like this.
Yes, and the canteens, the men who owned the canteens and owned all the profit that was accrued, would vote in canteen committees to buy something good for the ship and so on. And so the men provided quite a bit in their own way.
That's great. Now, how long did you remain with the Skeena?
I was there 2 years in the Skeena. In 1933, I dared to get married and was shot off back to England to specialize because of my athletic background. I was asked to specialize in physical training. PNRT, we called it, physical and recreational training. And I had to go to Portsmouth and undergo this very strenuous physical and recreational training. I was very upset and about that. Once again, I arrived there, and there was no course organized in the Royal Navy for me to go to, so I hung around the gymnasium getting what I could, waiting for a course to start. When I happened to playing a game of soccer one day, I broke an ankle. And so off to hospital I went, and I was kept in hospital until my leg had healed a bit. Then I came back and I limped around the gymnasium for a month or so. When the captain, who later turned out to be a very courageous admiral commanding the Murmansk convoys during the war, Bob Burnett, he sent for me, and I think he was looking for an out to get rid of me. I think I was a nuisance around the place, so he said that I was fully qualified, and would I get out of there and go and join a ship, HMS Cairo. She was the flagship of the Home Fleet destroyers, and my job was as the PNRT specialist, was to organize the recreation and games and so on for all the men in 27 destroyers, which there was a lot of competitions going on, and soccer matches and so on, which I did without being too happy about it, because I didn't feel that I was fully qualified to do this.
You're still a lieutenant.
Yes, I was a lieutenant until 1936. I had to serve 8 years as a lieutenant.
Were there any other Canadians around at this time, or were you?
I used to meet one or two every now and again, and there were quite a few Canadian officers on loan to the Royal Navy for training in Royal Navy ships. I used to meet them here and there, everywhere.
Was there any discrimination at all because you were Empire rather than
none whatever. The Royal Navy was a tremendously fine training ground. The officers were accepted on a par level from every point of view, and disciplinary wise, we were treated identical to those officers of the Royal Navy. You couldn't tell one from the other. And we carried out our jobs just as well as they did. And so on. But at the same time, there was these spasms of coming back to Canada in a small, tiny outfit. Comparatively,
mm-hmm.
where training wasn't at that high level. And I think it was very beneficial that we were sent back every now and again to the Royal Navy to get the advantages of being in a big fleet.
You mean recharged, I guess.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Well, did you have any personal qualms or worries at this time about the direction of Canadian forces, especially the Canadian Navy? And
well, with the introduction of Skeena and Saguenay into the so-called Canadian fleet, we were encouraged. We were encouraged by the most minute evidences of an improvement.
The bottom started to look like up again.
Yeah, we'd all seen the bottom. After all, when you've reached bottom, there's only one place to go. And
but didn't it ever get the best of you, I guess is what I'm trying to ask. Didn't you feel so, just so, I guess, sold down the river, let down by the government, let down by what you wanted to do and what you felt the service should do? Didn't
well,
that
yes,
hamper
we,
your effectiveness? And
we all had ideas of grandeur. Most of us didn't believe that the last war, the First World War, was the war to end all wars. We felt that there was no guarantee that we would not be at war again. And we all appreciated the dire necessity of good training, long periods of training. And
we're only looking at a very small number of officers and men in the Canadian forces at this point.
Yes, about 1,600, 1,700.
Didn't that bother you? I mean, that wouldn't fill up a battleship.
No, nowhere near. No.
Let alone have a battleship. You had one, you couldn't fill it up. Didn't that seem to... Or did you spend much time dwelling on that, or is it just my being cynical, or what?
Well, we didn't dwell on it, really. I think we were discontented, but we were grateful for small mercies. And we felt that we had, with the reserve having been established across Canada, we felt that we would soon give these people the necessary training, and we were a force capable of expansion.
How would you feel towards reserves now? Did you really honestly believe that reserves could come in and take over the jobs of...
Well, of course, I'm very reserve-minded, and I believe that without a strong reserve, Canada's making a great error. This was proven, of course, in 1939, when a small force of 1,700 eventually expanded to a force in the neighborhood of 100,000, and all of them were reserves. True, they didn't do very well in the early stages of war because they didn't know up from down. But in wartime, you gain experience so rapidly that in a matter of course of a couple of years, we had some very fine units.
Oh yes, I'm not trying to, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to, put down the accomplishments. I guess what I'm trying to get at though is, with such a small, limited investment on the part of the Canadian government towards reserves, towards the regular forces, towards everything, I find it hard now, looking back, I know it's much easier for me to look back, but I find it hard to understand how one would not be very angry and annoyed all the time and really questioning the effectiveness of the service.
Well, I think we did. I think we were always unhappy that more money was not available, more ship construction was not being carried out, more training facilities, better facilities in our shore establishments, better facilities in dockyards and so on. We were all very unhappy about that, but there was nothing we could do about it. We recognized our political masters and that they had a job to do. And traditionally, Canada has never accepted the advice of admirals.
Mm-hmm.
as Mr. Pearson says in his book, Mike, he said, when they integrated the forces, he said, a lot of admirals and generals complained bitterly. Unfortunately, they are not politically important. And we always had this feeling. We were rather white-collared people. Did what we were told. But I must say, we were unhappy about it.
Did it cause much dissension, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. Was there an undercurrent all the time that things were not the way they should be?
No, no. Every ship as a unit is... was completely happy within that unit. We had jobs to do, and we did them, and without complaint.
We swallowed your pill and then went on.
That's right.
That's very good.
Yeah, I think morale in the Navy was, if there was any failures in morale, it was because of Canada's antipathy towards the big Navy. We detested being called Canada's Tin Can Navy, of course, and we detested some of the things that were written about us in the press, not so much the regular press, but in Halifax, I remember there was one communist paper that referred to us as English-accented badminton-playing, tea-drinking naval officers, which was hard to take.
Well, we have, at this time, were you aware of world politics, things that were happening? We're talking like 35, 36. Was there a feeling of apprehension? The isolationism trend, the breakaway of ties with Britain, was this just for academics to discuss?
Oh, yes. as Hitler started to rattle his sword, we were very concerned. Very concerned indeed. But it didn't seem that we had any plans. I think the naval officers had plans ready to submit, but the almighty dollar controlled everything, and everybody waited to the last minute, which was disastrous for the Canadian Navy, of course, to wait until the last second before we even recognized the fact that expansion was essential. And even after the 9 months of, first 9 months of the war, we didn't do an awful lot.
Well, there was a great influx of money in 36 to the Canadian forces and expansion by the Liberal government. I guess the realization that things have to be improved. Now, did you notice it? Was it a day and night change, or was it a gradual, or?
Oh, yes. Well, we bought... 4 more destroyers from the Royal Navy. We took 2 over at a time. I was sent to England to get ready the ship which eventually became the Celeron, and I was her executive officer. And we went to Chatham Dockyard and took over that ship, and she was completely committed. She and the Fraser were the two first two, and then the Ottawa and the Restigouche came along later. And after war, the leader of those 4, the destroyer called the Kempenfelt, became the Assiniboine, and we took her over. So we got 5 destroyers right at the beginning of the war. Well, of course, this was a tremendous boost to morale.
I was thinking more of the 36 era, though. 1936-37.
Yeah, well, this happened at about that time.
That we started bringing these ships in.
I joined Saint Laurent in 37.
37 itself.
And brought her out to Halifax first, and then we came around to this coast. And there was an exchange made, and the Sauron stayed out here. And the Skeena went back in order to keep classes of ships together. So we had four destroyers out here. At that time, that would be in 37, 38. And of course, they all disappeared from here in 39 when they went back to Halifax.
Back to Halifax, of course. You were promoted now in 36 to what, Lieutenant Commander?
Lieutenant Commander in 36, yes. Spunyarn Major.
Of what?
Spunyarn Major.
Spunyarn Major.
That's what we're always called within the Navy.
I've never heard that before.
And you've not heard that.
Yeah, that's great. What changes did this promotion make on you?
Well, practically none. Everybody recognized the lieutenant commander who was a lieutenant with 8 years seniority, and it didn't change your duties or anything. And I shipped the half stripe in 36 and continued on my same job. I was the executive officer of a destroyer at that time. That was the thing that was made me wonder since the times. Here we were, very experienced officers, and yet we were second in command, and so on. And I remember one destroyer that had one commander and three lieutenant commanders serving in her. And each of those lieutenant commanders was quite capable and experienced to command his own ship, which had been.
Well, that's a regular Incredible. Destroyer is a lieutenant commander usually, or a captain of a destroyer usually holds the rank of lieutenant commander.
Yes, the junior ships.
The junior ships.
Yes, the half leader, half in command of four of them, you'd find a commander and a captain at in head of all nine, as a rule.
But you're having three lieutenant commanders on one small destroyer.
That's right, yeah. It was just the state of affairs that existed at the time. Not by choice.
Well, I guess you'd have actually more firepower under your control than as a lieutenant with the Mediterranean fleet. And more, would be authority in that. Admiral Lear said this to me, that as a midshipman he had more firepower under his control as a midshipman, of course, with the Royal Navy than he did until he became a commander and had his destroyer out here. Didn't that strike you as odd, or was this not so for, in your case?
Well, I don't know what his job as a midshipman was in a
battleship.
There were a lot of people above him that also had the command of that same firepower. He was carrying out a midshipman's duty, which are relatively minor within the chain of command.
Mm-hmm.
And in gunnery in a big ship, a lot is involved, and a lot of people are involved.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, though, is that it's not the particular incident itself, as much as his responsibilities and areas, or your responsibilities and areas as a lieutenant with the Royal Navy. What rank would you have to gain in the Canadian Navy at this time to get virtually equal responsibilities?
I don't think that applies. It's a question of who's available for the job, and we didn't have enough flow of junior officers coming along in the dark days, in the poverty-stricken days.
I'm off on the wrong track here.
The result is we had to use relatively senior officers in junior officers' capacities.
Yeah.
But whatever took place, the training was there. It's the longer you can spend at sea and in exercise conditions and that kind of thing, the better it is for everybody, regardless of rank.
Mm-hmm.
And having lived through it, I can only appreciate the experiences that I had. which allowed me to take over the responsibilities which eventually were mine.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to have had command of a destroyer as a junior lieutenant commander, but such was not the case. There were too many senior people fighting for the jobs.
Was command of your own ship the overriding concern at this time, to have your own command?
Well, it was something we all looked forward to.
This is a key ingredient, I guess, in the naval
yeah,
is that correct?
We went through a period where there'd be a big shift around of all officers within the Canadian fleet. And once the shift was over, you'd shake your head and you'd find out you got the same bosses that you had 2 years ago. And that didn't tend towards happiness. There was a little discontent there. But as I say, we didn't have the flow of junior officers coming along in sufficient numbers to fill up the junior berths. It was a grave error, in my opinion, that we didn't have enough flow of junior officers. You can always count on a certain amount of wastage, and we suffered very little. But what we had was a couple of officers per year coming in, which is in no way sufficient.
Drop in the bucket, eh?
Drop in the bucket.
Well, up until wartime now, we have, you became an exec. On the, no.
In the Saint-Laurent.
In the Saint-Laurent, you're lieutenant commander.
Yeah.
The captain of the ship would be who?
The captain of that ship was, first one was Roger Bidwell, who retired as a rear admiral. And the second one was Captain Adrian Hope, who retired as a captain in Halifax.
Did your duties change much at all here, or do you get much sea time?
Yes, we got a lot of sea time in that ship, a lot of exercise periods, and money had relaxed considerably. And we were allowed to use our ships at speeds in excess of economical on practice occasions and so on, whereas previously we were very limited in oil fuel. So we had a lot more freedom to move the ships around. We went to the West Indies and met up with the cruisers and so on, very valuable. In the springtime periods, we'd be away 4 months on those jaunts. We produced an extremely fine group of men. They were loyal and they were wonderful seamen, and they were really very able people. Unfortunately, we lost too many of them in the early stages of the war, and so they, in the loss of a couple of destroyers, a lot of those men disappeared. I was in the Saint-Laurent for 2 years, and I just left the ship and was appointed to command the Venture, which was a sailing ship designed to train men in sail, a copy of the Blue Nose.
Oh.
And I was appointed to her out of Halifax. But the war clouds were gathering.
When would this be, 39?
This would be in 39. And the war clouds were gathering, and I actually took command of the Venture for 3 days. And war broke out. And I was appointed as executive officer of Stadacona, what was to become the big naval barracks of Halifax.
Well, what now? Now, when you're on the venture and that, we have England declaring war and in Canada waiting. Now, were you active? What was the situation for week-to-week period?
We knew that Parliament had to be called.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a decision to be made in Parliament. And but we knew darn well that we must prepare for war. And as a matter of fact, that started a good deal of time before England declared war. And we were told to prepare for war. So there's a good deal in taking a ship out of peacetime routine and getting her ready to be shot at.
Mm-hmm. Was there great excitement?
No, it went very methodically, and so on. The officers in command would hold meetings and laid down all the procedures that we were to go through, which were pretty well established by that time. And we prepared them for war and stripped them of everything. And spit and polish became secondary. Ammunition was built up to full stocks, full wartime stocks in our magazines and shell rooms. And the ships were properly stored for long passages and so on.
Was there any shortage of materials and things at this time?
No. There was not shortages insofar as our ships were concerned. There were shortages in the dockyard of facilities and everything to do a job, and where time was of the essence. But my chief interest, of course, had become personnel, especially after I was appointed to Stadacona, because there we had to accept the brunt of the expansion. We pulled in all the reserves from all the way across the country, leaving just a nucleus to look after recruiting and basic
mm-hmm.
training, such as they were to do. And we started grabbing these men and shoving them into schools, rather insufficient schools.
Well, where did you start? This is something that I find
difficult. Well, we started with what we had, and we expanded it as we could. We had, for instance, the whole object of the Navy had changed overnight. All of a sudden, we became an anti-submarine force, which we regretfully had not anticipated. It didn't seem to me that we had anticipated that we were to be strictly anti-submarine. We had always played with big fleets, and where the battleship was the big pièce de résistance, and so on, and here we were to play as rather individual ships surrounding convoys and so on. So our whole outlook changed very rapidly. We had to train men, although we had the equipment established in our ships for anti-submarine, the Aztec gear, as we called it then, sonar as it's called nowadays. We had no trainer, a synthetic trainer, a table which on which you could fight wars and battles
mm-hmm.
with submarines. A very clever gadget. We had none of that. And it arrived from England, and we had to put it together. We didn't even know how to put it together. So we found electricians and experienced electrical engineers and so on who put it together. We had one anti-submarine officer loaned to us from England who was a godsend. He arrived out and he started in training people in these classes of actually how do you attack a submarine using this equipment with depth charges, all we had. And we gradually trained men and sent them to ships where they gained the experience so necessary. We manned about 39 ships in the first few months we were there. We took over all the RCMP ships, which were anti-rum runners.
Mm-hmm.
And civilians had been sent down to the States armed with money to buy yachts, big palatial yachts, and they kept pouring into Halifax, and we kept pouring the crews into them. Fortunately, we were supported by quite a large number of experienced sailors from the merchant service, and whether they were in the reserve previously or not, they came in, and they were good navigators, and we could safely send a ship to sea, knowing at least we had one man on board who would get it back.
I think we're just about out of tape, so maybe we should just shut her down for now.